Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jonathan R. Lapham, Ph.D. He's co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project and editor of Independent Science News. Dr. Lapham is also the director of the Poison Papers Project, which publicizes documents of the chemical industry and its regulators. Dr. Lapham holds a master's degree in crop genetics and a Ph.D. in virology. He was subsequently a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Genetics, University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's published scientific papers in disciplines as diverse as plant ecology, plant virology, genetics, and genetic engineering. Dr. Lapham talks frequently at international events and scientific and regulatory conferences on the research conducted by the project. He's written for Truthout, MIT Technology Review, The Guardian, Resilience, and many of their magazines and websites. Today we talk about Bill Gates' plan for agriculture. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thanks for having me back, Derek.
So the reason that I, the thing that triggered me requesting an interview with you again was your essay on the Gates Foundation Series 2030 plan that pushes agenda for agribusiness. And that also, before we start, I recently have seen a whole bunch of ads on TV saying how great Microsoft is because artificial intelligence is going to feed the world. And it sounds like another attempt at a green revolution, which was, of course, a disaster for the real world. So can you dive in wherever you want?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there is a whole kind of bandwagon building around using data. You know, data is the latest quick fix, the magic bullet for fixing agriculture. And so here at Cornell, you know, I don't work at Cornell, but it's just 300 yards from here. They have a whole project that they're very excited about to use big data for agriculture. And the Gates Foundation has a similar thing to use big data for agriculture. And, you know, to some there are people who really believe that this is going to make a huge difference. And then there's people who understand that for the most part this is just a scam. But there are, you know, so there are so many angles being played on this. You know, one is taking information from farmers. Some of it is creating a kind of fake idea of how we're going to fix agriculture. Part of it is trying to imply to people that agriculture is broken in the first place, you know, which in some by many, many measures it is, but by the main measure that people tend to talk about, which is feeding the world, agriculture is doing just fine, thank you. So there are so many angles to take this, you know, that one could take this in that. But I just want to, you know, kind of open with a kind of general idea of what some of these directions might end up being for our discussion today.
So I guess let's start by talking about how is big data going to, according to them, how is big data going to improve things?
Yeah. So, you know,
what is their position?
Yeah. I mean, it does, you know, we're talking, you know, some of these people are talking about third world agriculture, you know, Indian small farms in India. Some of them are talking about, you know, the Midwest with precision farming and so on and so forth. And so we're talking about a lot of different people talking about, you know, using the same buzzwords for completely different situations. But, you know, the Gates Foundation is talking about using big data to understand the plight of women, for example, in agriculture. So they're trying to work out, you know, how many men do farm, how many women farm, who controls the income, who controls the, you know, who actually does the work on the small holding and so on and so forth. So some of them are talking about meeting Millennium Development Goals. And then some of them are talking about, you know, adding more seed in a certain part of the field or more fertilizer in a certain part of the field so that you can, you know, be more efficient, like not add fertilizer where there's already enough, that kind of thing. So there's all these kind of plans, but, you know, if you think about whether any of them are going to really transform agriculture, then that is a more difficult thing because it's not clear that any of them really are going to substitute for actual fundamental understanding of what's going on, and it's not clear that, for example, you know, applying a little bit less fertilizer on a corner of a big field is really going to make, is going to be a game-changing thing. So there's a lot of, you know, once again, there's got a lot of complex agendas that are going on, but they don't really add up, in my view, to a transformation of anything. This is about, you know, certain people trying to make a lot of money, talking up big things, talking up their careers, talking up, you know, making the system go round and round again, if you like. It's like, you know, lots of people are, you know, building startup companies based on fake meat or fake, you know, technologies or, you know, high-tech versions of agriculture that are basically, you know, trying to create plausible scenarios to attract investment people and then have those investment people then sell on their shares to somebody else. You know, these are in many ways agribusiness Ponzi schemes. Right, that is also part of the game here. It's like trying to attract investor interest in all of this.
So, I would like to hear more about that in a moment. But before we go there, I would like to ask you about a couple sentences from your essay about this. Mm-hmm. You wrote, "Productivism, as it is called, represents an agenda. It is a premise whose well-recognized effect is to remove the politics from hunger and poverty." And there's a couple directions with, well, first off, can you just tell me what those two sentences mean?
Mm-hmm. So, well, productivism is this idea that the problem of agriculture is that it doesn't produce enough food. You know, that we need more bushels per acre of whatever it is that's being grown. And so, and then when the farmer produces more bushels per acre, then they will have more money and the world will have more food, and hey presto, we will solve the problem of hunger. So that is the productivist kind of idea. There are many other approaches to improving agriculture. You know, the one that I think personally is most promising is based on the idea of food sovereignty. So this is about, you know, local people making local decisions about what it is that they need in their agricultural system and having, you know, a more distributed set of power relations around, you know, who produces what, who gets the subsidies, who gets to sell it to who, or do we have this kind of, you know, do we want to maintain, right? Productivism really is about maintaining and exacerbating a kind of feudal serf relationship between many, many farmers and a small number of operations that buy their products, you know, big supermarkets, big distributors, international commodity brokers, and so on and so forth. You know, there is a whole kind of discrepancy between the power of those big organizations versus the power of farmers, even on who have, you know, 5 and 10,000 acres. Those people are, you know, they only have one price that they can sell their product at, for example. You know, they don't negotiate anything. So they have no power in this system. So productivism is about ignoring all those power relations, basically.
And it seems to me that, I mean, certainly the ads I've seen for this agenda all really push this productivist agenda. And it seems mm-hmm. to me that this productivist agenda is one of the problems with capitalism in general, because I'm thinking about how, okay, so a mega farm in Iowa is able to produce 3 times as much corn as they used to, and in a globalized economy, as opposed to one that works with food sovereignty, the net effect of that is to drive small subsistence farmers, corn farmers in southern Mexico out of business, mm-hmm. because the price that they got forever in their local community has now collapsed because it's much cheaper to import it from Iowa than it is to get it from the local people. And this whole productivism is, it seems to me, I mean, of course, it also leads to all the horrors of factory farming. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this interview, is because this whole notion of productivism is so incredibly horrifying to me.
I mean, it does perpetuate a system that is unequal and even worse than you say, because, you know, in the case of Mexico, for example, there are subsidies in place that make sure that corn from the U.S. gets sold over and above corn from Mexico, for example. So you have a system where Mexico corn is rotting in the fields in Mexico and literally going unharvested, and whereas the pretty much identical corn is being grown in the U.S. for a profit and sold to those farmers, and ending up with a situation where small growers in Mexico are driven off the land. So yeah, so there's a whole basket of things that many people, you know, have difficulty understanding about agriculture, because it's not talked about in the New York Times. It's not, you know, it's not even talked about much on left-wing media outlets and so forth, because people are very disconnected to agriculture and the iniquities of the agricultural system as it's constituted at the moment.
So how will big data and this new plan, how will it affect how will it, in a tangible sense, okay, you were talking about them sort of being Ponzi schemes, so it sounds like you think that they won't actually affect the real world much, but insofar as they do, how will they affect it?
Yeah. So, you know, what is going on? You know, I mean, there's many aspects to this, but, you know, the idea, the Gates Foundation, you know, I talk about how they want to use science to manipulate public opinion. That is the purpose of this project. But in order to do that, you can't just have the Gates Foundation say that they want to appoint experts to write scientific papers to make donors give money to one sort of agriculture and not another one, you know, i.e. this productivist project. So they have to insert into that a sort of mystification, right, that we're going to do that better than any other scientific group could do it by introducing this machine learning process into the data set. So, for example, that, you know, there are thousands of scientific papers that have been published about how to improve agriculture, how to, you know, grow more corn, how to grow more sugar beets, how to grow more soybeans, and so on and so forth, or grow cattle more efficiently, or whatever. There are thousands of these papers. But, you know, most people, you know, are not sufficiently interested in just having another set of experts come along and tell them what to do. So the kind of mystery ingredient that this project is adding is this machine learning process. And machine learning, to me, is a giant red flag. Like, I do not understand that machine learning can actually interpret the scientific literature any better than a person who's, you know, been around and traveled and so on and so forth. There is no meaningful way in which that is likely to happen. But it is a way of having the Gates Foundation add another layer of sort of fake objectivity to what it is they're doing. And so you have this, and what it does is, what they're doing is reproducing a system that has been in operation for a long time. There's a book called by a sociologist called Theodore Porter. It's called Truth in Numbers, or Trust in Numbers. And what his thesis is that basically people use complicated math to bamboozle people into doing what they want. Right? If you can design an algorithm or imagine a machine learning application or have a kind of computerized mangle that you can that it has a sort of logical premise that you can apply to this data, and then have that to talk up a good story about how this is going to improve the objectivity of your data set and the objectivity of your outcomes, like the risk of bias tool that they're talking about. So you've got all these kind of fake ideas about how your data is going to be better than everybody else's. And then you publish that and you try to convince people that at the end of the day, they should be putting their money, their donor money, into Project A and not Project B. And what Bill Gates has in mind is productivism versus food sovereignty, right? He doesn't want people, seemingly, putting their money into food sovereignty approaches. And there is this whole food sovereignty movement, which is growing up around the world, that's based on, non-monoculture agriculture. It's based on agroecology. It's based on things like permaculture. It's based on improving the soil. It's based on food sovereignty. It's based on all these totally different concepts than the kind of intensive, industrialized, massive combine harvester kind of agriculture that people do in the U.S. And what Bill Gates is trying to do is shift the needle, if you like, more in the direction of this American style, massive combine thing versus what he sees, I think, as a threat from these agroecological approaches, which actually work on the ground, right? They actually improve farmers' income. They actually give farmers more time. They actually use less pesticides. They actually have all these benefits, which industrialized agriculture is supposed to have, right, in many cases, but in practice often does not, because it's basically beholden to big companies and big, John Deere. It's about buying that kind of agriculture. The big row monocrop agriculture is really, at the end of the day, about buying products from John Deere, from Monsanto, from Bayer, from the big seed company. That is the purpose. The fundamental purpose of that kind of agriculture is to provide a livelihood for these huge American corporations, right, that are now spreading around the world. So that's the kind of big picture dynamic that's going on here.
And, at this remove, I completely understand what you're saying about a lot of people just will throw up their hands and say, I don't know anything about this and it's all just too complicated. But after, sort of the destruction of family farms through the 1940s and 50s, up through then the second wave of destruction through the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and the destruction of organic through big organic through the 1990s, this is just a pattern that we have seen again and again, where big ag and productivism have consistently destroyed small family farms and subsistence farmers. And I don't see how. I mean, it takes a lot of gall to, and takes a lot of chutzpah, I guess, to be able to continue to push this same line when every time it's happened before, it's merely led to increased centralization of control.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what are the figures right now? I don't know what they are, but they're like four companies control 80% of the pork market, and three companies control 80% of the beef market, and three companies control 80% of the rice market. Those are not quotes. Don't quote me on those. But it's the centralization is really extraordinary.
Yes. Yeah. It really is. But what Gates wants to do, you're quite, I don't know the exact numbers either, but they're very similar to what you suggest. And what's interesting is that, the Gates Foundation is trying to push these models on developing countries, on India, on Africa, and so on and so forth. So, like, one of the reasons why they are, why they're able to push this story is that it's because it's in a new place, right? The Gates Foundation is not really interfering in U.S. agriculture for the most part. They're investing in U.S. companies and so forth, but they are trying to do this in Africa. And it's very interesting, just this last week, somebody who's considered in India to be the father of the Green Revolution, and widely admired by the establishment, at least, if not people who actually see many problems with the Green Revolution, he's actually come out against GMOs. It's causing a lot of consternation, apparently, in the Indian establishment, and not surprising, because this guy has been the person they've looked up to for the last 40 years, 50 years, for his achievements in agriculture that they've respected and enjoyed and reaping the benefits of, coming out and basically saying GMOs have failed in India. So there is pushback, especially in these other countries. There's a ton of pushback. And that's why the Gates Foundation's agenda is so interesting, because you know, they must be aware of this pushback, right? They're aware of all these interesting possibilities out there that offer visions of completely different ideas of democracy, of how to live on the land, of how to sustain civilizations, and so on and so forth. And they, but they're continuously pushing on this thing, and you get the impression that, that Bill Gates is just, you know, he's a kind of small-minded person who just cannot see any big picture thing. Then the money, you know, the money from his foundation has to go through him. He can't understand the idea of why people wouldn't like big corporations. He doesn't understand about ideas of democracy and so on and so forth. You know, he's been brought up in a corporate culture. Like, corporate cultures don't do democracy, right? They are basically about top-down control of things, and computers even more so, right? So he's reproducing all these ideas for these developing countries, which of course has been done before by the Rockefeller Foundation and by other American policies, and that people, you know, have intellectually repudiated a thousand times over. He's just going ahead and pushing right on and doing the exact same thing that has been tried and frankly not succeeded.
So you've mentioned democracy a couple times. Can you comment on the wonderful statement by John Mohawk that there is no sovereignty without food sovereignty? So mm-hmm. What's the relationship between this centralization of food supply and democracy?
Mm. I mean, the classic comparison with the way that people try to explain food sovereignty is that, you know, a person in prison can have food, but they don't have food sovereignty in the sense that the authorities, you know, decide what they eat. The authorities can take it away at a moment's notice, right? And the idea of food sovereignty is that the population, the farmers, the eaters, are put much closer to the driving seat of what is actually been made, right? Like, what is, you know, that allows them to make decisions as much as possible for themselves about what is culturally appropriate, what is seasonally appropriate, what is of good price, what allows them to live the kind of life that they would like to live. So, you know, we have this, you know, totally sovereign kind of set of ideas in our society in which, you know, certain people get to make decisions and other people don't get to make any decisions. And even, you know, even in the kind of wish fulfillment of Bill Gates, you know, there's still this whole notion of supermassive corporations that sell you items off of a production line. You know, I was talking to somebody today, the Gates Foundation's idea at one point of solving the food problems of Africa was to subsidize fast food. And this is his mindset, right? But subsidizing fast food, you know, you don't get even a choice of how much you buy. You know, you buy French fries, you get two different sizes of French fries. You know, you buy a large or you buy a small. Or you get a certain burger and it's a certain size. So if you're a child and you can't eat a whole one, you still have to buy a whole one. And if you're an adult and you can't eat a whole one is not enough, you've got to buy two of them. And then you got to waste half of it because half of the second one because you can't eat all that. There's no decisions being made by the consumer in all this. So, you know, even in his best case scenario, there's still no decisions being made. And the idea of food sovereignty is to turn that on its head.
So let's segue here to another essay you wrote about quote, Gates Foundation hired PR firm to manipulate UN over gene drives. And I want to mm-hmm. Mention a couple things, and then I want to ask you something. So first off, you talk about a UN committee called the, quote, Ad Hoc Technical Expert Group on Synthetic Biology. And I just have to tell you that the phrase synthetic biology scares me.
It gives you the creeps. Yeah.
Yeah. And second, you talk in there about how the first sentence, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation this year paid a PR firm called Emerging Ag $1.6 million to recruit a covert coalition of academics to manipulate a UN decision-making process over gene drives. So can you talk about gene drives, which I find even scarier than synthetic biology?
Mm. So yeah, I mean, a gene drive is a piece of DNA or a set of pieces of DNA that can be added to the genome of an individual, and the idea is that when that individual reproduces, in every offspring that they produce, there is a copy of the gene-driven of that piece of DNA. So the normal situation in genetics is that if you have a gene that encodes a protein and is different, you basically have two copies of every piece of DNA. And you know one gene encodes a copy of one protein, another gene encodes a copy of a slightly different protein. That normally half of your offspring will have one copy and half will have the other. The idea of these gene drives is that all your offspring basically carry that single genotype, so that basically it's obliterating the idea of biological diversity, and it's replacing it with a trait chosen by a scientist, and that trait is normally intended to have some kind, you know, most of these visions, it's intended to have some kind of harmful consequence on the population that carries it. So the idea is that you exterminate mice, or you make them unable to carry a disease, or you exterminate mosquitoes, and so on and so forth. So in the sense that because all their offspring carries a gene that is then designed to be harmful to them, every time they reproduce, all those offspring have the gene that's also considered to be harmful to them. So essentially the whole population is driven extinct by containing these genes that ultimately turn out to be harmful to them. So that is what a gene drive is. And so this technical expert committee is basically helping the UN to decide, you know, what should be international policy in terms of, you know, should countries be forced to accept gene drives that are put into organisms produced by another country and so on and so forth.
So you said that in fairly in a fairly calm tone, but doesn't that whole notion what you're describing absolutely horrifies me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the you know, this is a very dangerous thing, right? You know, you've got institutions like there's a group called Island Conservation. They are historically a conservation group that have poisoned islands to get rid of rats in order to allow, you know, nesting birds, seabirds, and so forth to exist on those islands and not have their eggs be eaten. What this Island Conservation wants to do is introduce gene drives into rat populations on these islands and have that wipe out the rat population. And the issue, you know, the obvious issue with this is what happens if those rats escape onto the mainland. So you do this on some island off of Australia, which, you know, has been targeted by people already. You know, the people are discussing doing this. You know, they don't have the technology yet, but they have the idea. So the idea is you do it on an island off the coast of Australia. What happens if those gene drive the DNA, you know, in the rats gets back to the mainland? Right? That means that it will spread through the entire population of Australia. That means that one day, in the presumably not too distant future, that gene drive would end up, you know, it gets back to Asia, it gets back to North America, it goes back everywhere to places where rats are an important part of the ecosystem. If those rats are exterminated, then all of a sudden you've got trash building up on the streets because the rats are not eating it anymore. You've got all kinds of perturbations to ecosystems. So you have the potential for a humongous disaster to follow from these kinds of gene drive intervention. But the people who are doing them show, as far as I can see, no understanding that this could all go horribly wrong. And so what they're doing is proposing and making all these plans, and the Gates Foundation is in the thick of this, right? To make all these plans to roll these technologies out for mosquitoes, for ticks, for rats, for mice, for all kinds of organisms that they've dreamed up that they think that we don't want to have in the world anymore.
The one that I've mainly heard this about is mosquitoes. And it just, I find it extraordinary. And that there are quote, reasonable, end quote, discussions being had at various levels of government about eradicating mosquitoes. And you hear people who at least pretend to be sane going full speed ahead for eradicating mosquitoes without any consideration of the effects of the eradication of mosquitoes on bat populations, on dragonfly populations, on fish populations, on any of the species who are dependent upon mosquitoes for a significant portion of their food. It just strikes me as, I'm just saying the same thing you did about rats. The one that I've heard most is mosquitoes, which just I find completely horrifying.
But the mindset of these people, you know, it's an engineering mindset that they're applying to biology. It is a reductionistic mindset. It is also a very it's totally undemocratic, right? They're not asking anybody's permission. The whole point of this, to the UN discussion, is to have a democratic forum in which the discussion of, you know, what are suitable experiments, what are suitable release ideas, what are suitable precautions that should be taken, right? The whole point of that forum is that is the only place that I know of internationally where, you know, people can get together and say, do we think this is really a good idea, and so on and so forth. And the point of the Gates Foundation's intervention in that case is basically to derail those conversations before they even really get going and make sure that the field is open for whatever projects they have in mind.
And, you know, they put this in terms of either the protecting biodiversity on islands, which I am all absolutely in favor of. I have no problem with getting rid of the rats on a on an island. But you make a great point about rats escaping. Rats got there in the first place by humans, and they would get off on a ship too. But the second, and they also talk about malaria, but I want to emphasize here the last two of the other items in the list that you said that they've been proposed for. One is agricultural pests, because we know that would be one of the main uses. And then the other is, quote, potential military uses. So can you talk about either of those, or both of those, actually?
Yeah, for sure. So the, you know, one is the agricultural use. Many people think that agricultural use is the real goal here, that these, you know, eliminating malaria or eliminating ticks or doing stuff for public health is not really what anybody cares about. There's no money in that. There's no big, you know, apart from Bill Gates, there's no big push to do that. These things are a smokescreen for people who want to use it in agriculture, right, to get rid of Colorado potato beetles and things like that. So that's one highly likely probability. The other,
which has the same problems that we talked about elsewhere, that you put this into the Colorado potato beetle population, and then who knows what happens from there. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh yeah, so you know, just to go into the biology for a second, who knows if it doesn't make Colorado potato beetle infestations worse, right? That's one possibility. Another possibility is that it escapes into other species. Another possibility is that, you know, not having Colorado potato beetles turns out to be a jolly bad idea for agriculture, or that it induces some kind of totally different behavior in these Colorado potato beetles. Say they fly a lot more, or they're twice as hungry, or whatever it is. Like, you know, there's all these, you know, I made a kind of shopping basket of potential problems that could go on with this technology, which have nothing to do with just simple escape. It's just like unanticipated consequences of these things. You know, escaping rat is a perfectly predictable and downside of these technologies. But there are a whole bunch of, less predictable But in it, you know, you and I might make these predictions, right? But the people who are working on these technologies, they appear to be strangers to these kinds of ideas. So, and then the second question you had was about the military. Like, the military is, you know, they are, you know, it's really difficult to know what they're thinking here, because a lot of money is coming from the military. The military just has a lot of money. You know, they don't even know what to do with it for the most part. So, but they are spending it on these projects. They have one that was brought to light just a few weeks ago called Insect Allies, whose premise was that the insects that are being that fly around in fields can become, you know, agents of the U.S. state, right? That these bugs could fly around. Maybe they collect information. Maybe they detect signals of enemy attack. Maybe they go and eat somebody else's crop. Maybe my imagination isn't that fertile when it comes to these kinds of things. But, you know, they imagine all kinds of possibilities. And so they have this. So the DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, you know, the people who in the past, you know, designed, you know, got involved in making the internet and designing lasers and you know, weird high-tech weaponry and stuff, they have started funding this. And then when it came out that you know, this is all apparently being used as a, you know, this has military applications, that people are thinking about them, all the military scenarios, you know, what happens if the Russians do this, what happens if the Chinese do this, what happens if we do this, how are we going to respond, and all this stuff. Like, they all deny that this has anything to do with the military, even though it's being funded by DARPA. It's like, you know, it's a comment on the feebleness of our media, right? That everybody could have this conversation in the first place, right? That people, the military is funding something, and then it's accepted as a plausible denial that the military has no interest in using this technology. So that's, you know, that's kind of my little take home, if you like, of the military, the angles to all this.
Well, and why would we presume that the military, in case of a war, would only use this, or a made-up war or anything else, would only use this to go after Colorado potato beetles? Why would we not presume that they would not use this to go after wheat or corn or, for that matter, human beings?
Yeah. The military likes to, you know, they want full-spectrum dominance, right? That is their kind of motto, if you like, and biology is a big part of that. You know, this is the way they're seeing it. You know, they you know, in the same way they can expand into cyber warfare with the internet, they can expand into bio warfare, you know, even though, you know, it's my understanding is that it's illegal to do this kind of stuff, you know, under international treaties and so forth. So this is one reason why they have to deny it. But you know, if somebody wanted to sue them based on international treaties, you know, I don't know exactly what happens, but there's other countries that are also doing these kind of technologies. You know, the British are interested, the Chinese are interested in all these genetic technologies. It would be a really interesting question to know whether there could be legal pushback on this. Because you know, my understanding, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is it's totally not legal.
So what is it that that ties the two different essays that we're talking about, the first one about the Gates Foundation funding productivism, and the second one with them hiring a PR firm to promote gene drives? What ties these together?
I mean, apart from the Gates Foundation, right? The bottom line in many ways of this is using science for public relations, right? You're channeling your public relations effort into a scientific, into the scientific domain, you know, in the exact same way that pharmaceutical companies use the scientific literature to advertise their products. people listen. People worship science these days. They really respect anything that comes from the mouth of a scientist as a general statement. And so people like the Gates Foundation. They understand that if you can control the scientific literature, you can control the popular opinion. And so, and policymakers, right? They don't feel empowered to go against the science. So they feel empowered at least to take the science very seriously. I mean, they do take and leave science when they choose to. You know, Donald Trump all of a sudden is not paying attention to the climate data and so on and so forth. But if there's a cold snap, he'll start to pay attention, that kind of thing. So, but policymakers, you know, it's a very powerful way to influence policymakers. So, you know, in the latest article, this series 2030 project, they are using the scientific literature as a PR kind of gambit. And so you know, what they want to do is publish these highbrow, high impact publications, a whole bunch of high impact publications, and then use them to drive a media strategy. So they're going to get, you know, hopefully front page headlines in the New York Times. You know, the scientists say that this, you know, productivism is the best way forward for agriculture, and scientists say this and scientists say that, and Africa should do this and India should do that, and Indonesia should do this other thing. So they're trying to use science as a public relations tool. And so that is, you know, to me that is a very evil strategy. You know, this is what I, you know, people, you know, most readers that we have, they like to share articles about people being poisoned or GMOs running amok or whatever. But to me, this is a poisoning the well of understanding, is what these people are trying to do. And they don't, you know, for the most part, they're poisoning it, you know, kind of on purpose. You know, they have this agenda. But then the whole other part of it is that they're poisoning it even with agendas that are not acknowledged by themselves. You know, they have a genetic determinist agenda, for example, which they wouldn't even recognize. You know, Bill Gates is in love with Steven Pinker, apparently. And so they have these kind of, you know, New York Times photo shoots together and so forth, and article, you know, there's discussions of the two of them on the front page of the New York Times. But basically what's going on is that Bill Gates has this idea that people are robots. People are created by their DNA, and they have high IQs or low IQs, or they have, you know, good health or bad health, or crops do well or do badly because they have bad DNA or good DNA. And so these are even the unacknowledged agendas that all these people have, that they're basically using to squelch what would be much more nuanced, much more interesting, much more democratic vision of society and of the natural world. So this is the part of it that really interests me. It's like how you push back against people who are pursuing these agendas knowingly and unknowingly. And so this is why we write, for example, about, you know, my special interest in the Gates Foundation is their really explicit doing of this. So you know, this is a classic story from Cornell. So Cornell is the institution around the corner from here. I can walk to it. Cornell had one of the deans told a story at the 150th anniversary celebration about how they got this massive grant from the Gates Foundation, and the Gates Foundation said, you have to spend 20% of the money that we give you on public relations, right? So this is ostensibly a grant about, you know, making better food for Africa or whatever it was. He didn't even explain what the grant was. But the Gates Foundation, kind of what they wanted to do was for Cornell to talk about how wonderful the Gates Foundation was, how wonderful this project was, about basically talk up the ideas behind the project, the premises behind the project, all these things that are, they amount to anti-democratic manipulation of the media landscape, of the knowledge landscape. And that is the part of it that I find so interesting. And also, you know, beyond the physical harm that these gene drives could cause and so on and so forth. This is the kind of, you know, part of it that is missed by most people most of the time. It's that, you know, in the longer term, if people just manipulate science, it becomes unrecognizable as a system for generating knowledge. It just becomes a system for generating propaganda. And that is essentially what we've wound up with. You know, much of biology, the research, has very little to do with organisms. It has very little to do with fundamental, deep, and accurate understanding of what these organisms do under the natural conditions. It becomes more and more distanced from the actual reality that is underneath there. And so this is kind of what ties these discussions together for me.
And we have just a couple minutes left, and I guess I just have one more question, which is, you said something about pushing back, and how do, apart from you doing your work and us doing this interview, how do people push back against this agenda?
I mean, you know, that is the kind of, you know, when you're powerless, you know, relatively speaking, it's not so easy, you know, you know, and I'm still, you know, trying to think through, you know, I want to write a book about this in part. You know, it's like how much of science is really being messed around with by these people. And the, you know, there's a lot of small things that a person could do. One is go to the original, always go to the original information that is being alluded. Like if you read a New York Times article about how something leads to something else, or something is going to be a wonderful solution to something else, you go as close to the original source and you try to work out if that original source really, really says what the article claimed or the headline claimed, and very often you'll find that it doesn't. And so you know, what the simple thing you can do is not repeat what you hear in the media. The second simple thing you can do is assume that what you hear about science in the media is some kind of propaganda project that is going on. Like, why does a certain piece of scientific information out of the thousands and thousands of papers that are published every single day, why does one of them end up on the front page of the New York Times? Right? That is the sort of the question, right? And the answer normally is because somebody is behind it. And so you ask yourself, you know, what I spend my time doing is asking myself, who benefits from this information being shared? And then between looking at what the data says, how it's an exaggeration or a distortion of the original piece of information, you can start to piece together whose agenda is being served. Is it the military? Is it, you know, just simple capitalism? Is it the Democratic Party? Is it the Republican Party? Is it the military? Is it agribusiness? Is it the pharmaceutical industry? Because normally these big players are behind all of these things. You know, almost every story that appears that have some kind of scientific slant is there for a reason. And the reason is, you know, sometimes quite hard to detect. But this is the process that I go through, you know, with these papers and try to, you know, write articles and try to understand the big and the small picture of all this.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jonathan Latham. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.